trouble with the segment on immigration, operation, in quotes, wetback under Eisenhower that Trump points to. There's a new book by an author out of University of Illinois, Chicago, who was interviewed with by Mitch Jeserich, The Deportation Machine, The History of Deportation. So he's a very academic guy, but he's also brings things up to date in some ways, and I had excerpted out in a certain way, and I don't have access to that file, so I'll be trying to do that on the fly. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. We have a new app, and it was saying that I was on the air earlier. It somehow jumped up to 10 o'clock, even though it was 9:30, so not all of the kinks have been worked out on that, but you can hear the studio quality version of the WEFT programming on that device. And here's counseling service with Airshifter, who has this enterprise. Community support is always welcome in any form you can give it. Just check with somebody here at the station manager. In-kind donations, time, something else you might have. We get printing from Minutemen Press, who we'll be hearing next, if I remember to play it. Radio Free Labor coming up. I hope we have a full complement today. Alternative Radio was on earlier this morning, and it had an inspiring segment on labor issues from a flight attendant union's speaker. She was really dynamic. That is now alternating on Saturday mornings early, and then alternating with Sunday afternoon. So it's a little confusing, but you can find alternative radio here every day at 7 a.m. if you're an early riser, which I am, but I'm usually working on my show. Okay, sometimes I'm an early riser. Here's underwriting announcement, and we're already 3 minutes in, so things will not go as planned.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
Late breaking, we have a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal that I just added to the queue, so we're going to listen to that now, about differential enforcement of the law and freedom of speech. I guess it's kind of a touchstone today.
When the U.S. government brought charges against the Black Liberation Group known as the Uhuru House and its movement, the African People's Socialist Party, FBI agents raided homes and offices of its leaders and members, including Omali Yeshita, its chief organizer, and several others. This happened around the same time as the feds arrested New Jersey senior senator, Democrat Bob Menendez. Both men are around the same age, around 80, and both faced similar charges, being agents of a foreign government. Menendez, Egypt. Yeshitala, Russia. There, the similarities ended. Menendez, as a senator, was allowed to come in with his lawyers to enter a plea. Yeshitala, meanwhile, was both handcuffed and shackled. So much for equality before the law. Menendez was charged with receiving gold bars for his services, including other gifts. What did Yeshitala and his colleagues receive? Nothing. Not only that, but the government offered $10 million to anybody who would come out and testify against Yoshitomo. There were no takers. Menendez blamed his wife. Yoshitomo said everything Uhuru did was protected by the U.S. Constitution and the First Amendment. The jury returned for the senator, finding him guilty. The jury returned a verdict of not guilty for the Uhuru movement, finding they were not Russian agents. Unfortunately, they did return a guilty plea for conspiracy. But conspiracy to do what? Several days ago, the Uhuru Three, Omali Yeshidala, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville, received probation and community service. The Uhuru Three are free. They stuck together. They fought together and won a true and powerful victory against state repression. The judge, a Trump appointee, said that the group's actions were protected political speech. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
And he deserves a commutation or a pardon, too. I've been talking about that a lot in the last days at Biden Connect. Another tranche of pardons went down this week, but it didn't include Leonard Peltier and certainly didn't include Mumia Abu-Jamal. But it really should have. Okay. It's a bit of a scramble. We might get to Max Blumenthal before I get to Sam Husseini. They both were at the supposed press conference, which was going to turn into another speech. Blinken's been having press conferences, and they just turns out to keep talking and then have a limited number of questions. And, of course, not getting to the real critical questions, like from Sam Husseini, who has gotten questioned in with some of the underlings, but he was taken out with handcuffs on before he even got a chance to, well, I guess he did interrupt, and then he quieted down, and then they just summarily dispatched him. So here's Amy Goodman's regular commentary. If you heard Counterspin, they had an archival thing, but it was about the insurance industry and the uninsurability. The important fact, well, one of the important insights in it was that the insurance company is a big investor in fossil fuels. So they're making money by investing fossil fuels, and then they're having to pay out damages. But then they are also saying that when these places become uninsurable, investors swoop in and buy them and maybe can rehabilitate them. And I don't know if it's in a flood zone, raise them up and then make them sellable or something. Anyway. I digress. Here's Amy Goodman's commentary on the fires, and I haven't heard this yet, so hopefully the additional insights here. And I guess we'll get to Sam Husseini. I've been promising, well, no, we'll get to the segment about immigrants, the deportation machine from the scholar activist up in Chicago at University of Illinois, Chicago.
Scorched LA, the burning truth of Octavia Butler's science fiction. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The devastating fires burning Los Angeles stand as a monumental example of nature's profoundly destructive potential when accelerated by human-caused climate change. The Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire have together burned almost 40,000 acres and damaged or destroyed over 12,000 homes and other buildings, killing at least 25 people. These fast-moving fires vaporize entire neighborhoods in hours, even minutes, forcing residents to flee with what they could carry. These climate-fueled fires have also drawn renewed attention to the writing of the late Octavia Butler, who broke ground as a Black woman science fiction writer, and her novel, The Parable of the Sower, a dystopian tale set in California. In the book, climate change has completely disrupted society as we know it. Wealth inequality has spurred crimes of desperation and driven neighborhoods to wall themselves off and form armed self-defense groups. A new populist, pro-business, anti-regulation president gets elected, enacting policies that intensify inequality. Written in 1993, Butler's prophetic book is set in the years 2024 through 2027. The parable of the sower is told via diary entries of a Black teenage girl, Lauren Alamina. She lives with her family near Los Angeles in a walled enclave shared by 11 families. Octavia Butler grew up in Pasadena with her widowed mother, who worked as a maid for wealthy white families. The book's fictional community of Robledo is similar to Altadena, neighboring Pasadena. As a result of racist redlining throughout LA's history, Altadena developed as a largely middle-class Black community on LA's northern edge. The Eaton Fire has destroyed much of Altadena. Lauren Alamina, in one of her diary entries, describes how even the modest comforts of their walled cul-de-sac proved to be a target for those with less. She said, "Everything was getting worse. The climate, the economy, crime, drugs, you know. I didn't believe we would be allowed to sit behind our walls looking clean and fat and rich to the hungry, thirsty, homeless, jobless, filthy people outside," unquote. Violent attacks on the neighborhood increased, and after one in which her family and most neighbors are killed, Lauren flees with two others, heading north. In one passage during their flight, she writes, quote, "Fires are illegal. You can see them flickering all over the hills, but they're illegal. Everything is so dry that there's always a danger of campfires getting away from people and taking out a community or two. It does happen, but people who have no homes will build fires," she says. As early as 1993, Octavia Butler saw the threat of climate change. The Parable of the Sower was to be the first in a series of parable novels. It was followed by The Parable of the Talents, in which a Christian nationalist is elected president, promising to make America great again. Butler died in 2006 after an accidental fall, leaving the rest of the series unwritten. She's buried in Altadena. In 2005, in one of her last recorded interviews, Octavia Butler said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"I wrote the two parable books back in the 90s, and they are books about, as I said, what happens because we don't trouble to correct some of the problems that we're brewing for ourselves right now. Global warming is one of those problems. And I was aware of it back in the 80s. I was reading books about it. And a lot of people were seeing it as politics, as something very iffy, as something they could ignore because nothing was going to come of it tomorrow."
Octavia Butler continued, setting the scene, then reading an excerpt from The Parable of the Sower.
"I have a character in the books who is someone who is taking the country fascist and who manages to get elected president and who, oddly enough, comes from Texas. And here is one of the things that my character is inspired to write about, this sort of situation. She says, "Choose your leaders with wisdom and forethought. To be led by a coward is to be controlled by all that the coward fears. To be led by a fool is to be led by the opportunists who control the fool. To be led by a thief is to offer up your most precious treasures to be stolen. To be led by a liar is to ask to be lied to. To be led by a tyrant is to sell yourself and those you love into slavery."
We write this days before the second inauguration of Donald Trump, who's threatened to withhold federal disaster aid for California unless the state enacts policies demanded by Republicans. Of course, the climate catastrophe doesn't recognize borders, nor cares if a state is red or blue. Look no further than hurricane damage in North Carolina and Florida. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, fires still burn as authorities try to locate and identify the dead. In a city known globally for its creative output, life is now, sadly, imitating the art of Octavia Butler. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Difficult times. So another producer I go to quite frequently is Mitch Jeserich, and this is a guy that I've circulated his name to be perhaps part of the Friday Forum, so maybe he'll come down here from Chicago. It's recorded the middle of the week. Don't have that date right in front of me. Letters in Politics is the name of the program. You can search for it on the archive. I'm going to play a little bit from the first section and then skew forward to the or go to another device and hear this, some of the later section. It's quite wide-ranging. It's a historical view of deportation. I had this figure that I still am trying to get my mind around, that the U.S. has deported more people than have come into the country. And I'm trying to figure out how that's possible. Maybe he'll, maybe when he says it again, if I have that segment on, he'll explain it. So here's Mitch Jeserich introducing his guest for the day. And we'll get to a couple of sections of this since includes material about Operation Wetback, which Trump doesn't say that. And they don't have a fancy name, Operation something or other. Maybe because the name I just said was already taken by Eisenhower.
Our own Nora Barris Friedman from the EI and myself.
Okay. Go to Plan B, which is just to hear this section and not hear the first section of... we'll get to Dennis Bernstein with Sam Husseini in a little bit. As I mentioned, I forgot to bring my smart drive that I had put everything on very smartly. And so I'm reconstituting everything I did. And I hadn't... I did some tempo-less, pitchless tempo changes. So I'm going to have to do the other... Speed this up just a little bit. And here's Mitch Jeserich. I think he's doing an introduction right here. I think I cued to that part.
Our conversation with Adam Goodman, who is a professor of Latin American and Latino Studies and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He is the author of the book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. Another term we're hearing used a lot right now by Donald Trump and his supporters and people that will serve for him in his administration is harking back to what happened in the 1950s in this country, a Dwight D. Eisenhower era program known as, and this is a derogative, but this is what it was called. Maybe this is where the term comes from, Operation Wetback. What was Operation Wetback?
So the mass expulsion campaign of the 1950s, known as Operation Wetback, as you said, which is a derogatory term, a racial slur, you know, that needs to be used and understood in that context. I'm glad you prefaced that as such.
Is that where the term comes from, or did the term exist as a pejorative?
Well, it was
before?
Very prevalent around that time in the early to mid, or in the mid 20th century, especially because, you know, people who crossed the border in the Texas borderlands would cross the river, the Rio Grande, and then emerge on the other side, come into the United States, you know, with their clothes wet, which is what, you know, the term is drawn from.
So they called it Operation Wetback as it was already this derogatory term.
It was already a derogatory term, but it's worth mentioning that if you look in the historical record, whether it's, you know, the federal government archives, or you look at any mainstream media source, really, at that time, they were using that term in common usage. You know, it's commonly accepted, which in and of itself is, you know, is troubling, to say the least. But this was a mass expulsion campaign based on fear and fear-mongering, based on scapegoating, you know, many of the things that we've been discussing already, in which the federal government set out to expel as many Mexican laborers in the country as possible. It ends up being hundreds of thousands of people who are caught up in this operation. But I think that many people don't really understand how the operation worked on the ground. And that was one of the things I was able to uncover in the research I did. And part of what I realized as I got deeper into the research was that, you know, most people in the United States don't understand the history of deportation, and that they only think of it as when a judge, and it's kind of imagined immigration judge, orders someone out of the country after a hearing and a legal process in which their case has been adjudicated. That's not how around 90%, 85% or 90% of people have been expelled from the country throughout the last century and a half. Most people have been deported through expedited means in which they've received, you know, little to no due process and had little, if any, chance to fight to stay in the country. And these have been coercive campaigns that have summarily rounded up Mexicans in particular, but many others as well. And this 1950s expulsion campaign is a prime example of how this worked in practice. So even before the mass roundups started in the middle of June 1954, there was a publicity campaign leading up to it, which was meant to spark people to leave kind of on their own, what becomes known later as self-deportation. Right? You never come into contact with an immigration official. You just decide that things are so bad and life is so difficult in the place where I'm living that I'm going to leave preemptorily, I guess.
Fear, and,
or
right?
Preemptively.
People are experiencing fear. And people always leave if they feel, if they can leave.
If they can. And, you know, the reality is that not that many people did, but this was part of the campaign that proved crucial and critical in places like Chicago, where I live now, where more people left kind of in response to this fear campaign than were actually apprehended and deported. But most of the people who were removed during the campaign were from California, Texas, other places across the West Coast and Southwest.
It begins
and
in California.
Done so through
It begins in California?
It begins in California in the middle of June 1954. It moves to Texas and then later moves to Chicago. You know, I should mention as well that, you know, these mass roundups happened, and they included people who had legal status in the United States. They included people who are U.S. citizens, even in some cases, you know, based on large or widespread racial profiling. But let's also recognize that not everyone, including conservative business people in Texas in particular, wanted the federal government to come and take undocumented people who had served as essential labor in their communities. And I found a folder or two of letters in the National Archives of outraged farmers and growers in South Texas who wrote to President Eisenhower and his wife, Mamie Eisenhower, complaining about the Border Patrol's presence in their communities and taking away, you know, their laborers who had been there for, you know, in some cases years, and going as far as to compare the Border Patrol agents to Gestapo and to Nazis, and telling the Border Patrol agents, why don't you come and pick the cotton yourselves if you're going to take away our much needed labor? Which is just a reminder that, you know, the politics of immigration as we think of them today and the partisan nature hasn't always been that way either. There's been, you know, dramatic shifts and changes over time. But this is the campaign that that Trump has used to great effect to say that we'll carry out, you know, what will be even larger and more consequential deportation operation than President Eisenhower in the 1950s. It's thought of as the largest deportation campaign ever. In part, that was publicity. In part, that was kind of smoke that, you know, the Border Patrol and Immigration Service wanted to blow in order to, you know, gain more congressional appropriations and to celebrate all of their so-called accomplishments. And I don't think it's a mistake that the president-elect was also comparing himself to a World War II war hero.
Where does this campaign come from in before the creation that led to the creation of, again, a derogatory term, but it's what it was called, Operation Wetback? And did Eisenhower run for re-election on the issue of immigration?
Well, I mean, one of the things to remember is that, this was really important, obviously, at the time, and it was very consequential. It was national news, but it was one of many things that was happening, you know, during these early years of the Cold War as well, the Korean War as well, had ended, you know, soon before. Not too long before, I guess, this campaign took off. So it was one of many things that was happening at the time. But in terms of immigration, it really was incredibly consequential, because ultimately the goal that federal officials had was to push Mexican laborers out of the country, but also into the Bracero program, into this temporary guest worker program. So what we see is that, you know, there is a reduction of the undocumented population in the country, but many people, you know, came back either through the Bracero program or without authorization. And you know, that's something that never changed, was the demand for Mexican labor, as well as the many connections that Mexican people had to the United States since they had been, you know, coming for, at that time, years, decades, or even generations.
I just want to underscore and underline and really focus for a moment on the role that fear plays in all of this. Last week, mm-hmm. I interviewed Pedro Rios, who's an immigrant rights activist in San Diego, talking about how people are preparing for the Trump presidency. And one thing was clear, he said, if you are undocumented in this country, you don't give people your information. You don't tell them things. I mean, he told me the whole thing that they're telling folks to do. And just, it was clear how much fear was being felt in the community. And then, you know, we all know the consequences of just fear of itself, especially when it comes to, and I just started thinking about something I've been paying more attention of late, as for personal reasons, childhood trauma. And I just start thinking about the child, you know, the children who are here, who are scared and the trauma this causes. And most likely children who are going to be here 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. I mean, we're this is inducing, I'm assuming, trauma on children now and always has.
Yeah, that's without a doubt. And it is incredibly disturbing and certainly not, I think, what any sensible immigration policy should be based on is, you know, punishment and trauma, essentially, you know, and that's something that we see across time. People who are, you know, greatly affected, even if they themselves are not apprehended and deported. But, you know, fear has always been an essential part of these mass expulsion campaigns. And I think we see in the lead up to this next administration, it's been essential. So I'd been, I guess, contacted frequently this summer and fall, this past summer and fall, by members of the media who are interested in learning more about the history of deportation. And they're wondering what's going to happen. And will Trump actually be able to deport all the people in the country who don't have legal status? And I came to realize that people were missing kind of the boat in the sense that the campaign's already started through the fear that's being propagated and through the promises, the outlandish promises, whether or not he can succeed or not. And we know that things are going to be challenging and difficult. And we know that the fear is part of the plan. And so, as you say, I mean, people are organizing already, just as they have in the past. And that's another really crucial piece of the story that I tell, are the stories of organizing and activism and people, you know, who are fighting against these inhumane policies. And that's, you know, has an equally long history, which we should emphasize. It's not just one of, you know, people going along with these, you know, just really abhorrent policies that, you know, have used immigrants as scapegoats and demonized them and really created, I think, harmful ideas of belonging and who is and who is not a U.S. citizen, who is and who is not an American.
I'm going to pivot to that resistance here in just a moment, but I want to follow up on what's happening in the 1950s and these great mass deportations that are occurring. You document very closely what they actually look like, especially in the act of taking people out of the United States, putting them on cargo ships. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so for a couple of years in the middle, the latter part of the 1950s, U.S. immigration officials, in collaboration with Mexican authorities and private Mexican companies, in addition to some private U.S. companies, deported tens of thousands of people across the Gulf of Mexico on cargo ships that were designed and meant to carry produce, you know, bananas, for example, that were taken from the Mexican state of Tabasco to states in the U.S. South, like Alabama. And then on the return trip, these Mexican, privately owned Mexican cargo ships would pick up a group of deportees, 500 people, 800 people, depending on the ship, from Port Isabel, Texas, in the lower Rio Grande Valley, and then take them across the Gulf down to Veracruz, further away from the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, you know, what this was really was an attempt at prevention through deterrence, is what we later come to think of it as, and an effort by U.S. officials to make the conditions on these ships and to make the experience of deportation so miserable and so challenging that people would decide not to return to the United States in the future. And that doesn't happen. We know that if people do return, there's many factors that influence and affect people's decisions. But the conditions on these ships, you know, people liken them sometimes to 17th and 18th century slave ships. You know, the food was rancid. The conditions were just really inhumane. They were not built for humans to travel on them. But, you know, there are humans, in this case, Mexican migrants, were thought of as human cargo, not just by U.S. officials, but by Mexican officials and business people as well. So there's an important class dimension, class dynamic to this story. You know, and eventually this operation ends after there's a mutiny aboard one of these ships, where, you know, people jump overboard and, you know, it becomes a national, international news story, and it's no longer tenable for the Mexican government to support this operation. So it ends. But that's not to say that, you know, the punitive tactics used to deport people stops. And that's something we know that continues in various forms, you know, really in the decades since.
Can you tell me more about the mutiny?
The mutiny, you know, what we know is that, you know, there are a number of individuals who jumped overboard on these ships when it was nearing Tampico, which is a little less than halfway, perhaps, on the trip from Port Isabel to Veracruz. You know, really tragically, you know, some people died, you know, after jumping overboard. They were not able to make it to shore. And Their remains were later found, identified in some cases by the Levi's jeans that they were wearing. But this, you know, for understandable reasons, I guess, becomes really a flashpoint. And Mexican officials now kind of backtrack and try to go back on their support for the operation. But if you look at the archival record, you know, the Mexican officials were very much in favor of this operation and the ways in which they described Mexican migrants. I think people would find equally abhorrent as the rhetoric used by the U.S. officials. So in this case, you know, this operation is just one example, but we can really see the ways in which the business of deportation and the necessity to deport mass numbers of people relied on physical, psychological harm and also material costs, you know, so profits, you know, really drove this operation in addition to domestic and foreign politics. But there's these perverse economic incentives that, you know, are still around today in different forms, which people have probably followed in part through the stories about the private detention facilities. But I should emphasize it's not just, you know, the private industries and businesses that are benefiting that are driving these operations. It's also, you know, the public imperative. And this is something that we really see the policies creating the opportunities for. So as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, it's the policies that created a market and deportable people and turned this into a business. If the policies were different and people could come to the United States, you know, through legal means or regularize their status after some conditions were met, then they wouldn't be subject to these, you know, horrific experiences.
Adam Goodman, scholar now in Chicago at U of I. I used to say Circle, U of I, Chicago. And as I mentioned, I thought that he would be a good candidate for the Spring Friday Forum series. So I'm hoping that'll happen. The deportation machine, but you'll hear that again because I'm going to play the segment that I had planned to play. So it'll be in reverse order. So I'll do sort of the basic introduction. This is Mitch Jesuit's Letters in Politics if you want to hear the whole hour. And I think he's got it up on video too. I'm not a video guy. So I'm going to be playing Sam Husseini's recounting his interactions at the Blinken press conference, and also Max Blumenthal with some wider insights as well from him. It's a recent Gray Zone post, though it's co-posted with Judging Freedom, kind of a libertarian guy who, Judge Napolitano, I guess, who had a Fox show or was a correspondent or something. In fact, he gets calls from Trump every now and again. It's amazing. But what else is amazing is that I only found a Jerusalem Post review of the fact that Trump on Truth Social posted Jeffrey Sachs's, a segment from Jeffrey Sachs's Cambridge Union speech, where it was very wide-ranging, well worth seeking out. Cambridge Union, S-A-C-H-S. Watch all of it. But the segment that Trump shared was where Sachs called Netanyahu a dark son of a bee, and how, recounting that he got us into a lot of wars. The people don't remember there was a speech to the joint Congress, both houses, by Netanyahu in lead up to the attack on Iraq under W, and they were agitating for it. So Trump is like spreading this. Very subversive if you listen to all of Sachs, but he's basically animosity. And if I have time, maybe I'll play the blank BB excerpt, which is only a few seconds long. Trump is such a petty guy. He was angry at Netanyahu because Netanyahu called Biden up 4 years ago and congratulated him on his election victory. And that's enough to have lifelong hatred from Trump. But back to immigration issues. We're going to hear only another 4 or 5 minutes of this. Again, hope we can have him down here in person. This is Adam Goodman, Deportation Machine.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
the latter part of the 1950s, U.S. immigration officials, in collaboration with Mexican authorities and private Mexican companies, in addition to some private U.S. companies, deported tens of thousands of people across the Gulf of Mexico on cargo ships that were designed and meant to carry produce. Now, what this was really was an attempt at prevention through deterrence, is what we later come to think of it as, an effort by U.S. officials to make the conditions on these ships and to make the experience of deportation so miserable and so challenging that people would decide not to return to the United States in the future. The conditions on these ships, you know, people liken them sometimes to 17th and 18th century slave ships.
A conversation on the history of deportations, including on what was known as Operation Wetback. Our guest is Adam Goodman. He is the author of the book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wierzbianska. Red flag warnings around Los Angeles County are being lifted as threats of high winds subside and the two most destructive fires become more contained. Some residents who have lost homes in the Eaton Fire near Pasadena have been allowed to surveil the area where their homes once stood. As of this morning, the Eaton Fire is 55% contained.
Okay, best laid plans. Poorly laid plans. I guess we'll go to plan B and mention you can hear the entirety of that. Only have 24 minutes left, so why don't we go to the Sam Husseini interview with another producer I go to a lot. If you're regular listeners, Flashpoints, Letters and Politics, up front. There are many other great shows on KPFA if you want to look through the archives. And by the way, KPFA earned the distinction of being mentioned, the Pacifica Foundation was mentioned by name in Project 25. I don't know if that's in the cartoon version that's been circulating. Somebody took Project 25 and made a graphic essay out of it, I'll call it, instead of a cartoon. But I've only looked through a couple of pages of that, and I don't know if they cover KPFA's mention or not. Probably not likely, because it's a little incidental, but the war on the media will occur. I don't know how much will be directed at Pacifica, pushing the limits of allowable debate. Anyway, here's Dennis and Sam Husseini. Again, this audio was presented on Amy Goodman to the actuality from the press conference. I'm so happy that somebody spoiled Blinken's victory lap.
Hosted by producers of the powerful and highly informative Green and Red podcast. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are broadcasting today from the beautiful mothership, KPFA, in downtown Berkeley. And we are happy to be here and happy to speak with you over these free speech, no holes barred, corporate, truth to power radio. Welcome back to Flashpoint, Sam Husseini. Sam Husseini has been a contributor to this show. He has been monitoring the State Department for us. You were at the State Department today, Sam Husseini. The Secretary of State was there as well. You want to explain how things unfolded?
Sure. Well, there's the immediate context and the general context. The immediate context of today was Blinken. Finally, it's been like a year since he's been in the press room at the State Department, came on an hour's notice, I think, to minimize the chances that independent journalists like myself or Max Blumenthal would be there, and made very lengthy a speech, basically, rather than a news conference. And Max...
Blinken did.
Spoke up.
Blinken did. He made a long speech. It was supposed to be a press conference, yes.
Correct. Max, you know, spoke up and asked some questions and laid out a critique and so on and got escorted out. And then I attempted to start injecting very short questions. That was the posture that I took. And I've done this in the past. And they've basically attempted to ignore me. But in this case, they didn't ignore me. There's video now of Matt Miller, the spokesperson ushering in so-called security, and they came over to me and tried to get me to shut up and picked me up and literally carried me out.
All right.
Of the room.
Let's listen to a little bit of that, Sam. We've got some sound on that. Let's play Sam at the State Department with the Secretary of State this morning.
I was sitting here quietly, and now I'm being manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. Sir, you pontificate about a free press. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions, and so I'm asking questions. Wasn't the point of May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders. You.
Please, sir, respect the process.
Oh, respect the process. Respect the process. Well, everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel is doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal, why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you in the Hague? Why aren't you in the Hague?
That was Sam Husseini this morning as the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, looked on. Talk a little bit more about why you made this stand at this point and a little bit about your struggle to be heard by the State Department.
Sure. You know, I've gone to the State Department for several years most recently on behalf of Flashpoints. Sorry, I got to make sure that my phone stays charged here. I've been continuously, avoided. There's been a regular pattern of them attempting to avoid taking my questions because my questions are generally very tough and often well-researched and difficult for them to answer without looking like conniving, deceitful propagandists. It happened around several months ago. Last year, at one point, this might have been the cause. I don't know. It could have been several causes. But at one point, Miller, in response to somebody else's question, had this smirk on his face as he's talking about the possibility of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians getting slaughtered. And I just chimed up and said, You're smirking. You realize you're smirking as you say that. And Miller apparently took grave exception to this. And since then, he hasn't called on me, nor has anybody else, nor has the other spokespersons. And I went up to him last November and I said, "What's going on?" And he basically said, "I'm not." He basically admitted, and I'll be putting audio of this out tomorrow on my website. He basically said he's not going to take any of my questions. So it's been this attempt to not just simply avoid me, but to completely prevent me from getting any questions in whatsoever. And I think I have a pattern of asking the sort of toughest questions that they either can't answer honestly, or if they answer them honestly, they look ridiculous. I mean, like I asked Miller months ago about the Hannibal Directive. No one until then had asked him about that. And he pretended, I was surprised by this, he pretended to not know about it. He said, "I have no knowledge of that alleged directive." And then he, immediately called on another, a favored journalist who changed the subject very quickly. I attempted to ask today about the Geneva Conventions. They're not only running roughshod the genocide conventions. The U.S. policy is basically to refuse to apply the Geneva Conventions, the sort of bedrock of international law, to the Palestinians. This is basically why Israel was able to get away with so much, because without the Geneva Conventions, you basically have civilians without any protections afforded to civilians under international law. And the U.S. basically attempted to construct this false legal justification for Israel. But if you ask them directly, do you recognize the Geneva Conventions as applying to Israel, to the Palestinians, to Gaza, they will not give you a straight answer because they don't want to acknowledge that. So I think that what happened today was when I started chiming up about that, and Blinken from the podium was saying, I'll take questions. And then they called over the goons to get me out of there. They would rather have the visual of me being carried out than risk the possibility that I'd have a clean shot at a question to Blinken, for example, about the U.S. refusal to acknowledge the Geneva Conventions. I repeatedly tried to corner Miller and other spokespeople on this. And several months ago, another journalist, Liam Cosgrove, got Blinken in the hallway and said, and he tried to build on my questions and asked him, do you recognize the Geneva Conventions as applying to the Palestinians? And Blinken turned to him and said, is this on the record? And when Cosgrove said, yeah, it's on the record, Blinken refused to answer. They don't want to have that honest dialogue, even though Blinken is standing there at the podium when I'm trying to get questions in, saying I'm happy to take your questions. And meanwhile, Miller is getting these so-called security people to literally drag me out of it, literally carry me out of the room. Went out there, they handcuffed me, they roughed me up, they twisted my shoulder. They hurt my wrist. They walked me around the long way to get out of the building, I think in an effort to, you know, be able to manhandle me for a longer period of time. They did finally give me all of my possessions.
That's the voice of Sam Husseini. He is a special correspondent for Flashpoints covering the State Department. He was covering the State Department today, as all reporters who cover the Middle East and North Africa would be covering the situation around, is there going to be a ceasefire? Is it going to hold? There was a lot to be talking about. I can tell you that I did catch a glimpse of Matt Miller while you were being brutalized, Sam, and he was, again, smirking. He was trying to catch the eye of other journalists. He's sort of like the way 7-year-olds would, put a finger by their head to suggest that somebody is crazy or something. That's the feeling one gets from Matt Miller when he's dealing with you. Let's listen to let's work into the discussion now, what Max Blumenthal had to say. He was there, too. I believe he was at the State Department. I didn't see his face on the video, but it was certainly his voice. And he spent a minute or two calling out, if you will, the Secretary of State for his history. Let's listen to this.
300 reporters in Gaza were on the receiving end of your bombs. Why did you keep the bombs flowing when we had a deal in May? We all knew we had a deal. Everyone in this room knows we had a deal, Tony, and you kept the bombs flowing. Why did you sacrifice the rules-based order on the mantle of your commitment to Zionism? Why did you allow my friends to be massacred? Why did you allow my friends' homes in Gaza to be destroyed when we had a deal in May? You helped destroy our religion, Judaism, by associating it with fascism. You waved the white flag before Netanyahu.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
You waved the white flag before Israeli fascism.
We'll have the time to take questions
your
at the end.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day. You smirk through a genocide.
Thank you.
And again, that was Max Blumenthal talking to the Secretary of State at what was supposed to be a press conference. It wasn't much of a press conference, even if it was. What you get from Matt Miller is the same a variation on a theme, which is really being ignored. Sam, your thoughts now as you watch all of this unfold, I guess they were a little sensitive given that the Israeli plan to suppress the voices of Palestinians may have killed a lot of people, but it certainly wasn't effective in shutting down the quest for freedom among Palestinians in occupied territories and around the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Israel is conducting its forms of massive, brutal oppression on the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank and elsewhere. And, you know, I see the U.S. establishment and the Israeli establishment working hand in glove in order to perpetuate this imperial system. And part of what that imperial system wants to dismantle is any sense of international law, any sense of democracy, any sense of journalism. And so authentic, independent journalism that attempts to, and it was really funny. I mean, Max was brilliant in terms of chiming up. And when he did it, it was exactly right after Blinken, pretends to wax eloquent about how important a free press is and how he hasn't always liked to be held accountable, but it's such an important part of the process. And that's exactly when Max chimed in. That was great. And then they escort him out the room. And Blinken is just filibustering for time, giving, I think he's given a speech every day this week. Instead of having a news conference, because they don't want to take tough questions and they want to pretend that they believe in these things, but they don't, the same way that they want to pretend that they believe in international law and they don't. And too many, obviously, it's only obvious to KPFA listeners and Flashpoint listeners that so much of the establishment media is part of the same mechanism of the establishment, and I should say, as an Arab American, I mean, there are some exceptions to this, but a lot of the Arab journalists as well have sort of become appendages of much of the same system, and aren't really asking the tough questions there either. I mean, they're part of Gulf media. Well-funded outlets in the Persian Gulf and so on. So it just highlights the need for it's use it or lose it in terms of the First Amendment. And I didn't throw shoes at him or anything like that. Not that he doesn't deserve it. But I just simply used words and. Rather than, I expect it to be ignored. I expected them to attempt to deftly ignore me. And that's happened in the past. Several years ago under Trump, when Trump rolled in our old friend Dennis Elliott Abrams at a news conference, and I attempted to ask Elliott Abrams a series of very tough questions, and they had a handler on stage who was pointing to other journalists to get called on, and they did a very deft job of getting around my questions. I expected something like that here. I didn't expect them to be bringing in, four, hefty so-called security people to literally carry me out of there.
Wow.
In handcuffs. That's recounting the confrontation at Bloody Blinken's press conference, so-called. Mainly gave a speech. He was on Amanpour this week, and I caught a bit of it. I was going to read the transcript because I can't stand looking at him. Let's go to a little bit from Max Blumenthal talking about a variety of things. He was complimented there by Sam Husseini. That, again, was from Flashpoints this week, confronting Bloody Blinken. We'll just hear a few minutes of this. You can find this at the Gray Zone podcast in its entirety. Good stuff.
Before we get to what happened to you at the State Department, before we get to your analysis of the lies articulated by the Secretary of State as he was giving a swan song, the ceasefire negotiated and supposedly agreed to between Israel and Hamas, as you understand it, Is it a defeat for Israel?
It's I wouldn't qualify it as a defeat. I think tactically, Israel has suffered a number of losses, and there is no strategy. And we are what October 7th did was unleash a protracted war that accelerated the process that has been developing in Israel, Palestine, and in the region for many years. But to call this a defeat would be, I don't know, to look at it with rose-colored glasses, because tens of thousands of lives, and I think we're going to see that many tens of thousands more were lost under the rubble that were not known before, once reporters and investigators are able to get in. Those lives should have never been lost. The destruction of Gaza, even the loss of many of the hostages and captives should have never happened were it not for the savagery of Israel's patron in Washington, the Blinken, Biden, McGurk administration, which wanted to see this war go on as long as possible because it wanted to see how much damage Israel could do in the region to reverse the trend of multipolarity, the rise of the resistance axis. And they did succeed in doing a whole lot of damage, but the human damage is immeasurable. Right. So that was part of Israel's objective too. So I can't call this a defeat, but it certainly was not this was not a victory for Israel, and they certainly failed to achieve what Netanyahu promised, which was total victory.
Will Smotrich and Ben-Gvir leave the government if the cabinet and the Knesset accept this? I don't know how the Knesset could accept it if they vote against it, but let's just say the Knesset accepts it and the cabinet accepts it. Do they leave Netanyahu high and dry and confronting re-election while he's on trial for bribery?
Well, I think one reason Netanyahu was able to do this deal was also why he was able to extend the war, which was that he replaced his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, with Israel Katz, who is a sycophant, and he strengthened his coalition and expanded his coalition. And so Ben-Gvir and Smotrich don't have the same hold over Netanyahu that they had before. It is worth noting, in light of the ridiculous comments made at the State Department over the past 48 hours, that it was Hamas's fault every time for sabotaging negotiations, that Ben-Gvir has now come out and boasted that again and again, he personally prevented a ceasefire deal by undermining it through his power in the coalition.
Got it. Before we play these two very, very dramatic tapes, one involving you and one involving your colleague and friend Sam Husseini, set the stage for us. What was happening at the State Department when they dragged you out? What was Secretary Blinken saying? And before we run the tape, what message were you attempting to get across to him and to your fellow journalists?
Well, we'll discuss the message after watching it. Tony Blinken came in today for his final press conference and a curtain call, victorious curtain call, kind of a victory lap to tout his Middle East policy, pat himself on the back for a ceasefire deal that would have never happened if Trump were not coming into office. We got word early, actually at around 9:30 a.m. And so I raced in there and managed to get in some questions to Tony Blinken that I've always wanted to ask him I had to ask the questions under duress. I would have never been called on. No dissenters are called on by Blinken or his press secretary. And one of the purposes as well is to hold him accountable for what I consider to be the Holocaust of our time.
Max Blumenthal, you can find that at Gray Zone. Sorry, I didn't get the segment that I wanted, but we already heard his interventions about Blinken and you can find that on Democracy Now. That might be easier for you to get to. She had a segment with that, including the great Gideon Levy. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Let's get an underwriting announcement in, and then it's time for Radio Free Labor to let it rip. Thanks for supporting WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, in person at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign, or by calling 217-355-0500.